Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sorsini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Chris Benor.
On this week's episode, the UN meets to decide the fate of the internet and the US pushes back. Will your cell phones cost you full price in the future? Twitter and Instagram fight for your photo data. Apple's Made in America again. And will The Hobbit make you nauseous? Before we get into our headlines, I wanted to mention briefly here that I've been funding Kickstarter projects now for, it's been almost like 2 years now, it feels like. And I haven't received a reward from a single one of them until just recently. I finally got my very first Kickstarter reward out of, I think it's like 12 projects that I've funded. And it comes from like the most unlikely source. It wasn't the Pebble. It's not the Ouya or the Kick or anything high tech like that. I funded a animated short to be produced by John Crisafulusi, who is the creator of Ren and Stimpy Show. And so John Crisafulusi sent out the rewards, which was a drawing, a hand-drawn drawing from the production and signed and everything. So that was my very first Pebble, I mean, my very first Kickstarter reward from one of those projects. I'm still waiting for the Pebble. The Pebble and the...
At least they give you updates. I'm on some other things, and like you don't hear a damn thing from those guys until you write in and say, hey, look, I ordered this, and then they give you like a little update. But at least Pebble... They're focused on giving you updates on a 2 week basis. My Gmail account gets that email. I read it. Still working on.
Fake Grimlock was really good. He's the only person that I've gotten stuff on, and he was extremely, or she. We don't know who Fake Grimlock was. Just a giant robot dinosaur. It was pretty awesome about keeping up. If you're kind of worried about funding stuff through.
Kickstarter
because of that. One of the classmates in my incubator program, and they're also a YC class of 2013, spring of 2013, is trying to build a new type of Kickstarter that's going to hold your money in escrow until they actually ship it and then refund you if it doesn't.
Oh, nice.
That is the – I thought when I first saw Kickstarter, I thought the big thing was that you get your money back if it doesn't work out. I didn't realize – like when I didn't read it very carefully, obviously.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's like the best idea ever, because basically like if I know – if I'm a bank and I know that you have – you, Mr. Pebble Maker or whatever, widget maker, if you have $10 million in the bank because you had a successful thing, then give me that $10 million. I will straight up like – you know, make a bet based on like all the stuff I do, you know, my diligence to see whether you're going to pull it off, and then I'll back you myself. And if it doesn't work out, you know, I'll have you know, taken a risk on that, but I'll probably get a higher percentage of the money I'm holding.
And be able to give people. Well, they do a bunch of other cool things for the sellers too. Like they do like marketing and distribution for the sellers, and they even have like a white label solution so that you can. Basically use their platform but without having to like go through your site or through their site, so it sort of is on your servers and under your name and everything. It's definitely for like companies and individuals and people who are interested in products that are actually going to ship.
Ostensibly, when you fund a Kickstarter, they take your money and they use that to put forward the production of whatever device or project that the Kickstarter is about. How do they do that if your money is in escrow with this other project?
Well, so I hesitate to speak too much for another company, but I think
ways to pull it off though.
Yeah, I think part of their realization is that, I mean, So what happens with Kickstarter, Kickstarter is a spectacular deal for the creator. Like,
right.
Kickstarter is essentially a way of raising, like, large amounts of non-dilutionary funding for your company. Like, you could raise, like, $200,000 and not have to give away a single tenth of a percent of equity and raise your money. The problem is people don't think of it that way. People think of it as pre-ordering.
Right.
And so they build, you know, they give all this money to these projects, and then they get disappointed when they, you know, they lose their $50.
Mm-hmm.
Because really what Kickstarter is measuring is your ability to raise hype about yourself. But the thing that's good about Kickstarter, even if you're an established company, I think that they're really more aiming at groups that are a little bit more like mature and like know how to ship products. Kickstarter is a spectacular way to gauge market interest. Like,
yes.
If you are an existing manufacturing company and you want to figure out how to, like, whether or not a particular product line is going to be useful or not, like, or going to have market validation, like, you have to just sort of build it and then put it out there and guess. Whereas Kickstarter allows you to find out, like, well, is this going to be useful or not? So I think that they're aiming much more at that, like, existing manufacturer looking to expand, or a manufacturer that, like, really wants to, you know, get help with the marketing side of it. Because that's the other sort of half of Kickstarter, is that, you know, for every, you know, pebble, there's 100,000, you know, gravels that failed, you know?
Right.
Kickstarter is also a double-edged sword, too, because you gauge the buzz around the product that you want to make. Mm-hmm. And we've all seen products that, you know, like Google Glasses. It is an awesome idea, except for the fact that the thing that worries, I think, all tech people the most is that the implementation, at least in the first couple of gens, is not going to be anywhere near what they're selling in the concept videos. And I feel like that's the – so like when we get the Pebble, I can just see – I mean, they're going to have the Pebble. It's going to come out. It's going to be a success. They've made their money. People will buy it. But their reviews might come out and be like, just wait till version 2. And I feel like that's what the tried and true people who already make products, that's what they have going for them. Gauging that initial interest is definitely there. It's just the idea that, like, if you've already made products, you can balance those expectations a little bit better. I think you'll be that much more strong for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that these guys, and I wish I could tell you their name, but I think they're in stealth mode still. I think their real genius is this is a perfect example of the Bezos principle. So Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon, is pretty famous for his like proposition that you should always have your business interests aligned with your customers so that when you win, they win, and when they lose, you lose. And I think that this company is doing exactly that. Basically, like, it's in their best interest to ensure that successful products ship. Like, not just – and that's good for you as the consumer because it means that you sort of know that when you pay for something on there, you're actually going to get it. But it's also good for you as the person, you know, with the idea, because it means that they are going to do their very best to ensure that you succeed. They're going to ensure that your funding goals are met, that you have, you know, advertising for it, that people hear about it. I think it's a cool idea. I would really like to sort of push them.
Well, the incentive thing, I really feel like it needs to happen more. You shouldn't, I don't know. I feel like the whole, in the tech world, what makes technology so exciting is it connects people, it gets people involved. And part of that involvement when it comes to the propagation of hardware and software, I think, is making sure that people don't feel like they're getting screwed. And the best way to do that is to find a business model that doesn't look at the consumers as suckers, but looks at them as partners. Mm-hmm. The minute your consumer is a partner, it's the same minute that you want to do right by them. And when you generate that goodwill, you get the best press that anyone could ever get.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, you get the best layout, the best advocates. And I think you actually save yourself a ton of cash because you won't have to market as hard. So like think about Amazon. Amazon does a significant amount of marketing, but they don't do marketing the way like Walmart has to. You know, like people just, you know, like when there's a sale and there's not really like a whole bunch of sales on Amazon. Amazon doesn't really advertise in terms of like what it's got discounted. You just kind of know that Amazon's going to like, you know, be there and take care of it and like, you know, be reasonably priced or whatever. Whereas Walmart, who's also always going to be there and is reasonably priced, they're constantly having commercials about what to get at Walmart today or whatever, or like why Walmart's better. And it's because they have this history of like screwing their like workers and screwing like, you know, kind of being like opportunistic. And Amazon may be all those things, but you just wouldn't hear about it.
Mm. All right, let's move on here to our first headline. All last week in Dubai, delegates from 193 nations were at a landmark conference to talk about regulating the telecommunications industry. Some fear that that could lead a few countries, particularly Russia and China, moving to more tightly regulate local use of the internet too, if the final treaty includes text that they can use to justify potential acts of censorship. That could well happen. A lot of people believe that this treaty should ostensibly codify a global rule for the internet is kind of redundant because the countries that are already involved in censorship within their own countries, it wouldn't affect them because they're basically already doing it. The only ones that it would affect are the countries that are freer, like the United States. And in fact, the U.S., the House on Wednesday unanimously passed a Senate resolution that calls on the U.S. government to oppose U.N. control of the internet. So U.S. is already pushing back against any sort of potential global regulation of the internet.
And it's funny because I feel like a lot of liberals are really focused on, hey, U.N., have world government, have consensus, all this other stuff like that. Mm. But if you think about it, the consensus across world governments is like finite control of their people, what they think, what they can see, and what they can consume. And we are outliers in that. Like the, let's say, like the top eight industrialized countries are like outliers in that, with the exception of China. So I really feel as if this is something that'll get bipartisan support. Republicans hate foreigners hopping in there and trying to control our shit. Right. And it's not open enough for Democrats to like. So I'm excited to see that, you know, in this age of fiscal cliff, both sides of the House
they're actually going to agree on something.
They actually found something they agree on.
Exactly. They agree that no foreigner should come in and like stop their freedom, right? Which is, you know, great.
Yeah, though that's the thing I haven't really been able to figure out is like if this really is going to – I mean, I think what this primarily negatively could do is make it far more complicated and obnoxious when companies go international. I mean, because just because you're a U.S. company doesn't mean that you don't have to abide by, you know, the laws of the places where you're operating in.
That's exactly what it means. And, yeah, that you're in another place, you have to follow those laws. Which is why so many companies create smaller companies, subsidiaries, that, you know, they only deal with the laws inside that country rather than.
But for the most part, companies like Google are already following the laws of the host countries that they're in. Like, for example, when in China, there's censorship issues in China. You know, Google's pretty much hewn to their rules over there.
And when they couldn't hack it, they backed out and went to Hong Kong.
Exactly. Mm. Let's move on here. The Daily News Corp's attempt to create a newspaper for the iPad era is shutting down after less than 2 years. Now, I remember discussing this on the Drill Down when the Daily first launched. And I'm actually surprised that it lasted that long because I thought, well, first of all, I mean, you have a newspaper that's geared toward this niche device, plus it's behind a paywall. And I had predicted that paywalls weren't going to be, you know, when paywalls were first launched a few years ago for news sites, I had predicted that those weren't going to last very long either. People just don't want to pay for something that they've already – the genie's out of the bottle. They don't want to pay for something that they've already been receiving for free.
I think people also don't I think it's a little bit more complicated than that because I think it's like people want to pay for – like so I'm trying to think how to put this.
Start it over.
Rewinding. what's always bothered me about newspapers and other devices is you pay for them. Like you pay for somebody to deliver this to you and then you get it and it's still covered with ads. Like this is the same problem I have with cable. That's part of the reason why I don't pay for cable.
Wait, I'm going to stop. I understand the economics of it. A newspaper and a magazine are different. In a newspaper, there are specific sections, classifieds, whatever. You know, you're in the New York Times. You're going to see some ads here and there, but you can get the news really frequently. In a magazine, what a magazine is doing is it's making its content available for the specific purpose of appealing to a certain clientele, and that clientele is defined by their consumerism. So it's the same thing as cable. You pay for cable, but most of cable has commercials. You pay for the magazine, but most of the magazines have these ads in them. But when you open up Vogue, part of what it is, part of the content is the ad. When you open up The New Yorker, part of the content is the ad. You're supposed to be able to resonate with the product or service being marketed inside that publication. Frankly, subscription fees do not pay for magazines.
I realize that. I realize the economics of it, and you know the reason why a la carte cable is never going to come anytime soon, and that sort of stuff. I'm just talking about like part of what drives the market is the economics of it, but part of it is still the customer's scent of what constitutes a fair price for something. And I think that when you say that the genie is out of the bottle, I think that what we're increasingly feeling is, hey, I'm paying you for content, or I'm not paying you for content. Figure out how to pay for it with ads. And you know, there've been a large number of very successful media companies that have managed to make it one way or the other.
Have you guys seen Next Issue?
No. What's that?
So The Daily, for me, a big problem with The Daily was that it's showing up as an app on your iPad.
That you'd have to download every issue. It's not something
you have to download every issue, so it's a little bit of work there.
Right.
Next Issue is a business development coup. And what they've done is there's an app, you get it on your iPad. Mm-hmm. For $15 a month, you have access to about 40, 50 magazines. I'm looking at my Next Issue subscription, and I've got Architectural Digest, Car and Driver, Popular Mechanics, Fortune, People, The New Yorker, The Enforcer, completely unabridged. And when the new magazine comes out, I get an email saying it's come out, and my iPad will automatically download it. This is $15 a month. It's a negative option continuity. You get the first month free, all that stuff. But a big piece of why I think The Daily failed is because the cost for it, the $40 a month, the $40 a year, that's like the Evernote cost. And you're still locked in. You're locked into wanting to read those writers which hadn't necessarily proven themselves on a publication which hadn't proven itself. The question isn't to make an iPad-focused publication. The question is to get your publication, which is already focused on a demographic, onto the iPad or the Kindle or whatever device your demographic will be using. And I feel like that's the big reason why The Daily failed. Like that's
I like this this Next Issue concept. It's more like a format for the content that's already out there.
That's exactly it. I mean, Wired, Vogue, Vanity Fair, Esquire, Better Homes and Gardens, Time Magazine, Sports Illustrated, it's all on Next Issue. I'm looking at it right now. Mm-hmm. And it downloads when it comes out. Right? You have to tell it to do that, obviously, or else, you know, because it doesn't want to use bandwidth and it doesn't want to use battery and all those other things like that. But, I mean, that's the experience that works for individuals instead of saying, okay, The Daily, let's see what's up this week or whatever, you know? It's the reason why, this is what it is. The magazines already exist. The content already exists. People are willing to pay for it as long as it's a fair price. And given the cover cost of a magazine or just the subscription price of a magazine, if you're a person who does travel, who does like hop on the train to get to Connecticut and back to New York or travels a lot on the airplane, you know, this is the way to do things. This or just like a heavy use of Instant Paper.
Yeah. So I guess – I mean – so I thoroughly agree. I think that the problems with The Daily stem from something which I increasingly find myself saying, which is like the internet is not a magical place that changes all the rules. Like, you want to make a successful newspaper, you still got to make a successful newspaper, even on the internet. Like, making it for the iPad is not going to change the fact that it's got to be a publication that people want to read. And I never found the Daily to be something that even remotely interested me. Like, not to say that I'm necessarily the target demographic, but honestly, I couldn't figure out who the target demographic was.
Right, it's kind of the opposite of Instagram, right? Like, Instagram came out, it was only available on a telephone, and that kind of made sense because telephones became people's cameras. And Instagram added a little bit of functionality that made them feel just a little bit more like the cameras of old. So you were like, I'm going to use it as my camera anyway. Look what I can do with it without actually having to do a lot of work, like, you know, iPhoto work. Boom, I can share it. So that's a native – It all works together because it's a native use of your telephone, your let's call them like your personal communications device, because it is your camera, it is all these other things. It was a native use of that, and that's why when Instagram showed up and it was an app or a service just on the phone, unlike Facebook, which is on the web and on the phone, unlike Twitter, which is on the web and on the phone, people were like, how is this working? It's working because it's native. Reading is not native to a $500 tablet, especially when you can buy a paper for 25 cents. So you've got to do something to make it worthwhile. You got to do what Chris said, the Bezos principle. You have to align it with your user. And if you're going to sit there and think about the stack of paper you'd have to read any magazine, and you know, Andy and I were talking about how I hate DVDs and Blu-rays because of the commitment you have to make by picking one up and putting it in your PS3 or whatever. It's the same thing with magazines. I don't want to have to choose one magazine to read right then. I might want to read an article out of one and then out of another. Completely disparate topics. And I think that's where the iPad does come in handy. That's why I got the iPad originally for like comic books. I didn't want these big compendiums or trades of comic books sitting around. I just want to read them on my iPad.
Do you think something like a daily magazine on the iPad would work in the future, or is it just a fundamentally flawed concept?
I think you need access to a lot of value. And I think it's got to be kind of like Pandora. Mm-hmm. Like, I use Pandora One. I pay $40 a year, and I think that's a great steal for the amount of music I get commercial-free. With these magazines on Next Issue, I'm getting the same magazine I get otherwise, mm-hmm. and these guys seem to be buying into it. So it looks like everybody's winning. Yeah. And I feel like that's just kind of like the way to go. But the dedicated mag, I have that Engadget magazine on my iPad as well. And
Wired, remember Wired? They still have one.
They have one in the newsstand, but it's also in Next Issue. You don't have to get Wired. You can just get Next Issue, and the Wired magazine is on.
I feel like the internet, and I include tablets and the phone in this because I don't really I see this as much more a change in the distribution model than the specific technology that you're getting it through. I feel like what the internet has done is made it so that small niche publications that would never have been able to exist before can flourish and thrive, like the Drill Down. Like, you don't need massive amounts of capital and massive amounts of, you know, distribution to have a successful media group. If you can find a relatively successful niche, you can instantly achieve worldwide distribution. I think Startup Digest is a great example of that. I mean, we have a very, very, very strong brand within a very, very, very small percentage of the world as a whole. And yet we were able to be a perfectly successful media corporation based on that. On the flip side, instead of having the sort of like one-size-fits-all media mm-hmm. company that you used to have, like NBC or whatnot, what has taken over in terms of the big end is like sharing platforms, like something that enables you to find that content, whether it's social via Facebook or Twitter or algorithmic via Google. The point is, the big bucks are in finding and getting that information. And I feel like the problem with the Daily is it was sort of trying to do both. Like, it was trying to be like a sort of big, broadly appealing media group that had like crosswords and business and sports, but then also like trying to very much embrace the digital platform, which is much more associated with very targeted content and a very and or very broad shareable content.
Yeah, the one-stop shop is over unless your brand is ancient. If you're the New York Times, fine. I'll read you and I won't look at anything else for that half hour, 45 minutes. But the one-stop shop is over. And it's a good thing and it's a bad thing. It's a bad thing because, you know, Americans will go to MSNBC or Fox News and they'll just choose what they want to like look at instead of looking at something that everybody's looking at and having like a sort of like middle ground idea of what the news is. That's the bad part, right? You get lots of partisanship with these like crazy lefties on one side and these crazy righties on another. And then the good news there is that, you know, if you have a special interest, that special interest is taken care of by this ability to end, or you can like take care of it yourself by entering into a market that has very little barrier to entry when it comes to the content creation and distribution. So, and I feel like the Daily just kind of didn't get that. They were just kind of like, well, the iPad's a new thing. It's going to save journalism. I should get in on that early.
Right.
Yeah. It wasn't someone that no one who understood technology was really behind it. Right. And that's kind of why
I
failed.
That's like, why it was funded by Rupert Murdoch, someone who I think fundamentally does not understand new technology. So,
yeah, perhaps not.
Moving on here, T-Mobile USA CEO John Legere confirmed that the iPhone will be amongst the Apple products that T-Mobile sells next year, but he said that T-Mobile will sell it in a far different way than other carriers. They're eliminating all device subsidies in 2013, requiring new customers to pay full price for their phones up front, buy it on installment, or bring their own unlocked devices. T-Mobile will shift entirely to its unsubsidized value plans, which offer customers far cheaper rates for voice and particular data. With the value program, T-Mobile is keeping the contract but passing what it saves on subsidies back to the consumer. And the idea is that subsidies in general will be going away across all the phone carriers in the future. And that's a really scary concept because
no, it is not. This is the way.
This is the
it
way.
Is not scary
so are people going to be
I've been
paying...
arguing for this shit. For
okay,
a
let me
decade.
Ask you: are people going to be paying $600 for an iPhone, or is Apple going to lower their profit margin on what they charge for the iPhone?
I will say it doesn't actually matter, and here's why: Apple will have to adjust to the marketplace. But there's a big thing that has to happen in the marketplace. If you're not going to give me a phone that I'm – if you're not going to subsidize the cost of my phone, then I don't want to be in a contract. I want an unlocked phone at whatever cost it costs, and I want to be able to take it to any network. In this age of LTE and like world phones and everything, I should be able to take my iPhone from one network to another. With the iPhone 4S, it was pretty much – it's the same exact device. It got software locked once you activated it based on which network you were on in the United States. But it was the same exact device. The iPhone 5, unfortunately, doesn't have that. There are actually two separate devices with two separate sets of antennas, which is unfortunate. But I think if Apple keeps its current model where the new phone starts at $549, the next phone in the line is $300-something, and the cheapest phone is like, you know, $200, and these are all unsubsidized prices, and these are the base models, I think you'll still find people adopting iPhones. I think Android can do what Windows did and undercut that market. They'll have scaled versions of phones. But, I mean, even now, I think we're beginning to see that people want that choice. T-Mobile lost a lot of customers because people were locked in. They're like, I have unlimited and I can use the hotspot functionality and I've got this 4G thing that's not quite LTE, but it's cool enough. And that's cool. But in the end, you want to just be able to take your business wherever you want to take it. And I think that kind of flexibility is something that's going to scare Verizon and AT&T far more than it's going to scare Apple. Because people will buy the iPhone.
Well, and because, I mean, like, the iPhone is not the only subsidized device.
Sure.
Like, the iPhone, like, all the devices are subsidized. And honestly, Apple, part
except
of their
Google's
strength
devices.
Is... Well, yeah. But I mean, like, part of their strength is that, you know, they are able to get ridiculous profit margins out of their devices.
Yeah.
And honestly, if I see a negative out of this, it's almost more that if this forces the cost of phones to drop or conversely, it could cause phones to be the same price, but people upgrade less frequently, then it might force some of the smaller players out of the market if they just simply can't compete on the margins.
The small, like, you mean like the Crickets of the world, like the Khajiits and these other, like, you know,
Mexican. No, I'm talking the hardware manufacturers. Like, if you, if the hardware manufacturers like HTC can't get enough volume because the prices are pushed down or they're not, people aren't buying enough, then like it could push them out of the market. But I agree with you, man. I think this is a good thing overall. Like, the push for subsidized phones was an artifact of, you know, the early 2000s, late 90s, mm-hmm. when these subsidies were very much pushed to get people to adopt, you know, the phones and sort of keep renewing their cycles. But
and also just people to get phone, like, just to get on the cell phone. Like, cell phones are now, you know, 2013. I got my first cell phone that was just mine in 2003. 2013 will represent 10 years of me having a cell phone, and they're now just part of our culture. In order to get people into it in the beginning, you got to have to subsidize it. You got to give them, like, hey, I have a phone at home. Do I need a cell phone? Nowadays, you need not only a cell phone, but you need the data. You need the web. You need the music. You need the whole super, you know, personal communications device. That's what you need.
Yeah.
And I think the subsidy really gets you in there. And now that you've got you hooked, it's time to cut the cord, people, and pay your dues. And I really feel as if the good thing about the Apple devices is that they last for a long time compared to some of the other devices. So, So, I mean, you've got your glass and aluminum device that's going to stick around and not going to, like, crack out. And, yeah, you'll actually spend 2 years using it, or you'll spend, you know, 3 years or 4 years using it, because it'll be relatively durable instead of some of those more plasticky ones that I've seen people have to, like, replace, you know, after just 8 months or whatever. So
that's a good point. Forcing the smaller, cheaper players out of the market might not be a bad thing after all. I don't know. I think this is...
They might move to Asia. Who knows? They might not sell in the U.S.
This is one situation where I don't know. I feel like I might be ahead of the curve a little bit. Like, I have not paid... I have not gotten a subsidized phone for the last three cycles.
Really?
How much did you pay for your iPhone, or did you have your company pay for it?
No, I paid full price for my iPhone. I paid full price for my Droid, and I paid full price for even actually the last flip phone that I got, because
how
it wasn't...
How much did you pay for your Droid?
Like $400.
Wow, look at that.
Because I wanted something that was outside of what was subsidized for them, and so I, you know, paid out the nose for it.
You wanted these devices unlocked as well, I would imagine, right?
Well, I was dumb and I didn't actually get that. I just simply wanted something that wasn't available through there. I guess it was. No, you're right. It was unlocked, but, like, I never actually...
And unlocked doesn't always mean unlocked, because, you know, I've spent some time procuring telephones for journalists in order to do reviews, and I'd get, like, factory unlocked phones, but they weren't network unlocked phones. So,
well, yeah, that's the problem. So, like, yeah, that's what I meant. Like, so, like, if you're unlocked Verizon, your only alternative is Sprint, which I never was going to go to because they have no coverage.
Right. Exactly.
So it was unlocked in quotes. But the point was not the unlockedness. The point was simply what
freedom
I
from the contract,
hardware-wise and software-wise and control-wise, was not something that was subsidized.
Right, and there's a freedom from the contract.
Or very lightly
too.
Subsidized, like $25 or something, but, you know, basically a joke.
Yeah, because, like, my girlfriend, she's been off contract since 2010 when her iPhone 3G's contract was up, and I got her a 3GS, and then... just this year, I put it back on because we wanted to get, like, new phones and do this push down thing. But it was kind of freeing to not have her under contract, to think that if something new did come along, if some new type of program came along, she could hop off and go for it. And that's, you know, that's a peace of mind. And then you have these smaller carriers like you know, like the track phones of the world, who are allowing people to take those unlocked phones and get pretty good service out of them for half the cost. So there's that.
Yeah.
Instagram on Wednesday disabled the ability for Twitter to properly display Instagram photos in line on its website and in its applications. The move escalates tensions between the two companies, which were once friends in the battle against Facebook, but have now become direct competitors, or as Nick Bilton of the New York Times put it, welcome to the photo wars. Kevin Systrom, Instagram's chief executive, confirmed that the company has removed the ability to send pictures to Twitter and plans to completely cut off embedding pictures on the Twitter website. He said, we decided right now what makes sense is to direct our users to the Instagram website, noting that Instagram images will soon no longer be visible on Twitter. Obviously, things change as a company evolves. And Twitter, in its part, has begun its all-out assault on Instagram and in turn Facebook by including its own set of free photo filters. As of now, users will find 8 filters ranging from black and white to vintage, while their grid view enables you to preview how your image would look if any of the 8 were applied. So the photo wars are on. You know, Instagram and Twitter are now, you know, basically Instagram wants to drive all traffic to their own web pages, which they had just activated within the last month. And Twitter is locking them out, as they have locked out other services, as we've seen in weeks past.
Yeah, I gotta say it's I don't know who I'm more upset at. On the one hand, you know, Twitter's been changing the developer agreement in such drastic ways for so long. Yeah. In terms of like the web, you know. And it's been annoying to a lot of people who make wonderful like products that use Twitter. You know, like my Twistery calendar doesn't work anymore. Yeah. Half the apps I used to, IFTTT doesn't really work anymore or anything like that. The Instagram website is dull. It sucks. You might click on a picture that's a link, and the link shows, and it's a website where it's a dead end. You can look at the photo, or you can close it. I'm logged into Instagram right now. There's nothing to like really do there, you know? Like, it's not an interactive place.
You don't
they
have,
want to roll back.
Try Instagram.com/your your account name.
Yeah, that hasn't yielded me anything either.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a pretty minimalistic site.
It's a pretty crappy site. And the worst part is, if I go to Instagram.com, it doesn't prompt me to go there. Right? It doesn't prompt me to look at my photos.
Right.
I have to go to Instagram.com/ my name.
You're absolutely right about that.
You know, and that's the problem. That's one of the big problems there. So is Instagram cool? There's no doubt. It's a cool thing. But this kind of move is not one that helps the consumer. We were talking earlier about aligning the purveyor and their consumer. When you win, they win. And I'm not sure the consumer wins here. The consumer wins when they can share. And what's happening here is Instagram is moving toward monetization in a way that's obvious and makes it somewhat less cool. And one of the things about this is, like, remember when Facebook, when it first came out, they're like, no ads. We need it to be cool.
Yeah.
Cool is what it is. Whether you're looking at the Aaron Sorkin movie or reading the book about it,
right.
It needs to be cool in order to get adoption. That's what it has been. This is not as cool. I mean, people will use this site because they have to, because they're tied into Instagram. But thing is, people might say, I'm more about Twitter than I'm about Instagram. Now they're forced to choose, and that's not fair.
One of the wonderful things for the user with all these services was the social interaction between them. And now you're having all this segregation. And I feel like I don't want to be involved in – you know, if I have to send people to – if I can't do everything out of one sort of app, if I can't have my Twitter app send out to Instagram or vice versa, then I feel like I'm being hampered by my own applications.
Yeah, I mean, they have to make movies. They have to make money. They have to do things. It's not really free. We're just, you know, kind of it's borrowed time.
The first
we're on
taste
it,
was free.
Yeah.
But here's the question, like, that gets me about this. Were the filters the reason why you started using Instagram?
Kind of, because there were
novel.
Other ways. Yeah. I mean,
but it was also the sharing that made you use Instagram.
Right.
It
the sharing
to everything under the sun. Foursquare, Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, email,
yes,
Flickr.
Absolutely. That was definitely a plus, but I will admit that the sharing was second to the filters. And then when the filters
so
were no longer
the filters, it was important to you.
It was novel. I mean, it was novel at the time. Now everybody is doing filters. So
you know what I also think the filters did? In an age where the camera had like somewhere between 3 and 5 pixels, they were not the best photos that you were taking. They were not. But when you put one of those filters on, it made it look like an old picture. The resolution didn't matter so much because it looked like an old picture.
Right. And the ironic part about that is since then, the resolution on our cell phones have increased. I mean, the iPhone 6 is...
quality has improved quite a bit, too.
Right.
So, I mean...
This is my theory on Instagram, is that Instagram found a gimmick which was very successful early on. But I don't think that that's their primary value proposition. I think that what makes Instagram great is their sharing, their commenting, just simply the technical like ease with which, you know, sharing something on Instagram is. Yeah. Like, I don't know.
The UI, that's why they got bought. They got bought because they were so good at making a mobile application that had an easy UI but very powerful features.
Yeah. You know?
And
they're
already established user base as well.
Yes, that was a big part of it too. But when Facebook was talking about it, they're like, "Yeah, we get those 30 million people, but really, we need these guys' help on our app."
Yeah, I think it wasn't just the filters. I mean, the filters are a gimmick, but I feel like, I don't know. Looking at them, I feel like Twitter thinking, "Oh, well, shit, we've got filters now. We don't need Instagram anymore." Is like entirely missing the point of why.
Yeah,
Instagram. It's like looking at a BMW and being like, well, not BMW. I'm trying to think of a better...
Let's say a BMW. As I look at the BMW and saying, man, I really like the way the front has been consistent for the last 40 years, that whole like two circle thing, that's exactly why I'm getting it. Because no matter what, my BMWs will always have that. And you're kind of forgetting all the engineering behind it.
Yeah. I mean, it's something where like you're seeing the most valuable aspect of it. Okay, here's a better example. It's like looking at a KitchenAid blender and saying, ah, yes, the pastel colors and retro look, that's what makes KitchenAid great, and like missing all of the engineering that goes into making KitchenAid the best standing blenders in your kitchen. I know that's sort of more of a cooking geek than a tech geek, but it sort of captures that. You know,
I'm going to correct you right there. You're geeking out about kitchen tech, and that works.
Yeah,
that's
true.
That's okay.
Absolutely.
That's okay.
We can geek out about irons, like, and we can geek out about blenders for sure.
There's nothing particularly special about the Instagram like filters. And honestly, the only one I ever use is Lo-Fi because it basically just increases the contrast.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it makes everything frosty and cute.
No, it just increases the contrast. It just makes it look more like a normal photo.
Well, they also have that instant lens baby kind of...
Yeah,
they
let you use cool stuff when you needed to. But like, I feel like Twitter thinking that they need to just add filters and then they don't need Instagram anymore is dumb. And I think Instagram thinking that somehow they need to like fight against Twitter.
It's kind of a weird defensive move.
Twitter knows that people are on Twitter in many cases because they're Instagram first users. Mm-hmm. So they want to make sure that the functionality isn't lost. And that's really what it comes down to. Now, would it be better if Twitter said, hey, let's get on the phone, guys. We're a big part of your success. We've been giving you some success. You obviously like helped our adoption rate go up. What do we have to do to make everybody happy here? How can we both win? But it sounds like that conversation never really happened, and it was just a question of, hey, this is my public letter about what I'm doing because I'm Instagram. And Twitter's like, well, that's what you're doing. I'm not going to talk to you. I'm just going to do this thing myself because I can make my own filters. And there wasn't any real like strong like business development between the two working as partners to see what they could do to make the consumer happy. And that's what's yucky.
Well, keep in mind that Instagram is not its own company anymore. I mean, Instagram is a fully owned 100% subsidiary of Facebook. And as such, they are 100% serving the interests of Facebook.
That's fine. I mean, it doesn't mean that they can't get on the telephone and say, hey, let's have a meeting or whatever and just figure out like what you want. Maybe we can work together to make sure that we're both still, you know, in business. I guess on some level they thought it was cheaper to just throw some filters on there, but that kind of reactionary stance, again, doesn't help the consumer. I think it would have served everybody. I mean, I don't know what kind of conversations they had, but it seems from all the reporting I've seen, you know, sorry, that's just reporting that I've seen. I haven't spoken to anybody. That it's just a question of like one guy said something on their blog and the other guy's reacted instead of like getting together to see if they could figure out a solution.
Honestly, it really annoys me that Twitter and Facebook see themselves as such cutthroat competitors because, like, this is one thing I agree with Scoble on pretty intensely, is that I at least see them as very different. Like, I honestly do not want to go without either of them because Twitter is for broadcasting
and connecting with people that I don't know. It's for following people that I don't know. It's for being followed by people that I don't know. So whether or not I'm interested in just seeing what Justin Bieber is doing, or whether or not I'm interested in becoming the next Justin Bieber, it has something for me. Facebook.
You're saying Twitter is not intimate, though, and I feel like Twitter does get intimate. I mean, maybe this is just you're saying for you it's not intimate, but I think Twitter...
No, I mean just like in general, like it's intimate, but it's intimate in a like your it's primarily for connecting with people that you don't already know. Like you might become friends with them, but it's the primary advantage is that you. I mean, you don't like follow your girlfriend on there.
Or maybe your girlfriend, I do, but... your girlfriend's Twitter feed. You're not a follower of your girlfriend's Twitter account. You don't follow your girlfriend.
Well, I do, but she never posts.
Okay, I'm just saying.
Most of my close friends don't post, and honestly, most of my close friends, even if they do post, I hardly ever see them because they get lost in the noise.
I think a better way of saying it: that Twitter is public and Facebook is private, and yeah. Instagram has the privateness. Again, Twitter's public not just because. You know, you can barely hide your tweets. I think you have to be a private user or something to hide your tweets. But because the Library of Congress keeps all the public ones, and that's a thing. The public nature of Twitter also allows for things like political revolutions and so on and so forth. Whereas Facebook, you can lock down with granular controls everything that you're sharing and that you're saying. And while Instagram didn't have that, Instagram was intimate. I don't know how private it was, but it was intimate. And it remains intimate. An intimate being that it's on this handheld device that you always have with you. It takes a picture of that moment. It captures it. It memorializes it. It puts this filter on it that memorializes it even more, kind of just makes it a memory, so to speak. That Kodak moment is found on Instagram. And it's instantly shareable. It's like taking a Polaroid and giving it to a friend right there.
That's a really good, interesting distinction, the distinction between privacy and intimacy. Mm-hmm. Because I really feel like I've got to think more about that. That's a really interesting distinction.
I like that that analogy, though, that that you bring up, Dwayne. This is kind of like the Polaroid of our era.
Well, it's explicitly the Polaroid of our
era. Yeah,
like
that's the whole idea. That's why Polaroid's out of business, because Instagram. Right. I mean, okay. Instagram was the nail in the coffin.
Yes,
but it was the final blow in terms of that immediate instant gratification. So there's that. I just feel like it's sad that they have to fight on this level. What was my girlfriend just used this word like coopetition? They're in the same space. They're in the same space.
the consumer's mind. Dude,
so they have to cooperate.
Cooperation.
Right. Oh, and we're going to be talking a little bit more about cooperation later on in the second half of our show with Apple and Google. So
can I just make two additional points about this?
Yeah.
Actually, two and a half. So I want to know how cooperation is spelled because I want to start using that word.
I'll put it on the document.
That needs to be. That's going to go in the next tweet that I put out or something. It's awesome. Secondly, can I just say this is part of why when Instagram got bought by Facebook, this is why I was pissed, because it seems to me that Instagram is a power in its own right. Like when Instagram stops covering Twitter, like when it stops, you know, putting its things in the Twitter cards or whatever the heck it was, mm-hmm. like it makes headlines and people care about it. And like as much as it's great for them that they got bought by Facebook, like I think they could have been a very viable third player in the space. They picked up where Flickr failed to do so as – the you know photo sharing. And what is the internet particularly good at?
Sharing photos.
Anything else. It's really good at sharing photos. And I was really sad. Not because I'm mad at them, just because it just seemed like missed potential. It just seemed like Facebook had sold out to Microsoft in 2006. Like it would have been a great exit for Zuckerberg. He still would have made a good product. It would have been amazing.
But arguably, Facebook has become a great product. I think Facebook is far better now than it was back in the day, even though we gripe about every single change they've ever made. I think that the money that Microsoft gave them and the ability for them to remain independent was that was a business deal that really worked, whereas the Instagram deal is very different because what ends up happening is that Instagram is wholly owned. It's not just someone that got money from Facebook. It's someone who is now owned by Facebook, and they bought them as that acquihire that Andy was talking about. Acquihire, co-opetition, it's all like one big word jumble today. But the thing here is that when you look at Instagram, I think that the people who were funding them probably said, you know, it's not going to get better than this. This is that OMG pop moment where you just need to sell. For that kind of money, $500 million, $1 billion, whatever anyone wants to quote it as, I mean, you just can't say no. That's winning the lottery. That's spending 16 months doing some work and taking home enough money to never have to think about your resources again.
Well, and there are some things that have been going on in the market lately which have been an important reason for that. So there was a TechCrunch article a few weeks ago about how right now Silicon Valley and the general startup world as a whole is plagued by this problem where there is – a ton of seed money available. So there's a ton of money to help companies get off the ground. And there's not that much Series A money available. So in other words, there's enough money available for tons of companies to get their first 6 to 8 months of funding. But there's a dramatically less amount of money available to get their next sort of first million or two in funding available.
So you got to hit big and hit quick.
Well, it sounds like the difference between the Congress and the larger, Senate, right?
Yeah, that's part of a larger sort of thing that, like, there's a huge amount of money that was tied up in Facebook and still is tied up in Twitter. Yeah. And I think that an awful lot of investors thought that the Facebook IPO was overvalued and that there was too much money tied up in there. And there was a famous memo that went out from, I think, Ron Conway or one of the other big VCs in the area to all the sort of social media-based consumer startups being like, look, guys, exit. Exit while you can, because once Facebook IPOs and it doesn't do as well as everyone thinks it's going to, there's going to be a lot less money for exits. And so I think, unfortunately, Instagram was just a victim of poor timing. Like, they realized that they could have been a viable contender, but business-wise, it would have been a much, 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 much riskier gamble to sort of.
And
keep
how much
fighting.
Blood, sweat, and tears do they have to put in to get there? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it was a rational decision. Like, this is one of those things where I can't fault Facebook and I can't fault Instagram. They were both acting, you know, exactly as I would have acted in that situation. It's just, I think it's unfortunate that it came out that way.
It was a draw something moment.
That's what I was getting. That's what I
was Draw getting. Something was more of a like, holy shit, we finally made something that's popular. Let's bang on it.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Let's take a little break here. I want to talk a little bit about our sponsor, which is Audible.com. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the audiobook I'd like to recommend this week is a Christmas Carol. A signature performance by Tim Curry. Now, everybody should be familiar with The Christmas Carol. This is Charles Dickens' classic tale about Ebenezer Scrooge and who is like the meanest man in town and the lessons that he has to learn to try and be a better human being. And as told by Tim Curry, I mean, this is like the best of both worlds. This book, or any of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, can be yours for free by just trying Audible out. And to do that, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook. And even if you don't like their service, even if you decide that it's not for you, you don't want to be a continuous subscriber of Audible, you still get to keep Tim Curry's reading of A Christmas Carol. That is audible.com, and we're going to take a little break here, but before we do, we're going to listen to a little bit of music, so take a listen to this and come on back. Dungeons deep
and caverns old. We must away at break of day to find our long forgotten gold. The pines were roaring on the height. The winds were moaning in the night. The fire was red, it flaming spread. The trees like torches blazed with light.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Christopher Bernor. And let's talk about The Hobbit. As you may or may not know, The Hobbit is being released in multiple formats. And one of the formats that's being it's being released in is a 3D 48 frame per second format, which is twice the usual rate. And Warner Brothers had to issue a statement recently in reaction to a report in the UK's Sunday Times in which one anonymous viewer complained that of a migraine headache after viewing the film at the New Zealand premiere.
Another, so one person complained about this headache. That's everything I've read.
And another user compared the movie experience close to a roller coaster ride. And I don't, I'm not guessing that wasn't in a positive sense, but more in a negative, like grab a barf bag. Sense, and though the there's no physiological reason that a high frame rate should make make anybody feel sick, but Warner Brothers felt the need to jump on the defensive and speak out against this because they're afraid. Obviously, this is like you know, and the reason I bring this up is because this is cutting edge movie tech, and I feel like after this movie and after maybe James Cameron's next movie, which is also going to be shot in HFR, that 3D, that we're going to see a slow, gradual shift in movie exhibition to this new frame rate. This is the first real, true revolution in cinema exhibition since, you know, since CinemaScope, since widescreen. Warner Brothers says that they've been screening the full-length presentation and they've had extensively and they've had extremely positive feedback, with none of the thousands who have seen the film projected in this format expressing any of the issues described by the two anonymous sources and media reports. So,
it's about can I be data. A cynic about this?
Yeah.
Now, granted, actually, maybe you who have a little bit more sort of knowledge of... So is the primary difference here just simply it's a much higher frame rate?
It's twice as fast. It's 48 frames.
So that's really the primary difference. It's just twice as many frames per second. Is it possible that the problem could be caused by the frame rate that it's shot at not being equal to the frame rate that it's played back at?
It's actually shot natively in 48 frames per second.
And then play back at 48 frames per second.
Yeah. And
so, like, unlike one of those super fast, like, slow motion nature cameras where they're shooting it at 80 something frames a second and then playing it back much more slowly to get that really in depth look at that hummingbird by the thing, they're actually filming it with this high frame rate and playing it back at the same frame rate.
Yep.
And the quality is supposed to be better
because
your eye is getting more information. You're getting more pictures per second. So, I really feel like. I could see how someone's eye might not be used to it. 24 frames might be an easier thing because it's less information and your brain might be whatever. But I really feel like there needs to be more data before this becomes a story that I'm worthy of thinking about. Right. Two people out of thousands.
I can see a little bit. I mean, one big, huge difference between this – I mean, granted, real life is filmed at, you know, like several thousand frames per second.
Right.
And then our body plays back to us slightly – you know, faster. But I wonder if maybe, like, one big difference is that, like, stuff on the screen, especially in a movie theater, is a drastically larger field of vision than we usually deal with in life. Mm-hmm. Like, despite the fact that we see the world in that huge amount, we're not normally having that larger percentage of our vision taken up by that. I'm just hypothesizing because I'm getting to my main point, which is that this sounds like some sort of marketing stunt. Like, oh my gosh, our video is so high quality that it's making people sick. It's just so amazing.
Well, you know what
Especially since people are anonymous. It's like, gee,
right?
No one's coming forward and blogging about this. No,
that's because there are only some people who seem to have complained. They just complain, like, hey, I feel a little whatever, and you know, whomever brought the story to Dave McNary on Variety was like, oh my God, you've got to write about this or something. I just don't think that it's a story. I really think this is not a story until it becomes a story.
Well, you know what I found particularly interesting about this is that how well it echoed reports that I've read from literally over 100 years ago when films first were presented, people felt the same sort of nauseousness, complained about feeling the same sort of nauseousness or motion sickness from the time that they saw the first films. You know, one of the earliest films was a train pulling into the station, and viewers actually, like, ducked out of the way as the train was coming towards the camera. The effect was so...
Yeah, because they weren't trained in how to look at it. Just like when people first saw perspective in Renaissance paintings, they were like, I don't even understand what I'm seeing.
Exactly. And you know, I feel like that's kind of the same thing going on here with this...
Well, that's the thing. You would feel like that if there was actual evidence to suggest it. And again, it's two people out of thousands. Right. So there's no data to support this.
Well, let me ask you a question. If it's playing in HFR 48 3D in your neighborhood, are you going to go see it in that?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. I mean, this is – first of all, before we get to – let's go back to the whole thing we were talking about with the magazines. Yeah. Before we get to what kind of format it's on, this is The Hobbit. For many people, The Hobbit's like, it's a book that J.R.R. Tolkien wrote. For me, it is the book. This is the book that makes the other three worth reading for me. I don't care about the other three anywhere near as much as I compare it to this. This is like one of my favorite children's books. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm excited about The Hobbit just as a film. I'm excited about Peter Jackson being involved in the production of it. I'm excited about all that stuff. Now, you're going to give me an opportunity to look at the film in a new way. That seems to me to be less of a gimmick than 3D. Yeah, I'll give that a shot. No problem. Right? Yeah. I'll go in there. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time people saw IMAX, they were nauseated Everyone gets whatever. But it doesn't stop you from wanting to see it. Right. So I'm going to give it a shot, and I'm going to if it's playing in my area, and I'm going to check it out, and I'm going to be excited about it, and if I vomit, I'll come back and we'll talk about it on the show. But
terrific.
Until we get some more data.
That'd be a great show. I almost hope you do, just so that we can talk about it.
Well, by the time we meet again, it will likely be well after Christmas. So I plan on seeing it like first week that it's out.
Well, it's out on Friday, I think. So there you go.
That's right. Yeah.
I agree, Andy. So I've been one of my weird interests of this past year has been the history of fonts. And one of the big things that sort of always ties into when people come out with a new font is what makes a font legible? Like, is this font legible or not?
Yeah.
And like, historically, what's always made a font legible is, does it look like fonts that I'm used to reading? Like, there's not an inherent like legibility that's built into fonts. I mean, there are certain things that certainly make fonts very illegible. But after a certain point, what really comes is like our bodies and our eyes in particular, like, are very attuned to patterns, and like they see what they're used to seeing. And when something changes, they react accordingly. And whether or not that's a different font or a different type of frame rate or a different type of moving picture at all, I feel like if there is any sort of like scientific backing to this, it's just, well, this is the next thing. Honestly, I still find like HD video, like when I watch like TV shows on an HD screen in HD, it looks kind of weird to me. Like, I don't know. I can't put my finger on what it is. It certainly doesn't make me nauseous in any way, but it certainly just looks like off. And I can't. It's probably just I'm not used to watching HGTV because I don't really watch TV at all.
It's culture shock, basically.
It's, yeah,
you're not used to it. Let's move on here. Dwayne, you brought this next topic up to me, and I had no idea that this had even happened. But apparently, Motor Trend chose as their 2013 Car of the Year the Tesla Model S, which is not the more affordable model.
Slightly more affordable. Right. So Tesla, what is Tesla? American car company, came out in like, you know, maybe 2005. Elon Musk, one of the PayPal billionaires, said he wanted to do two things. He wanted to get to space and he wanted to make a car that was awesome. So his car that was awesome is called Tesla. It's named after the rival to Thomas Edison, the electronic maven. I guess he's a guy, so he wasn't a maven. Yeah. But the electronic wizard, Nikola Tesla. And the automobile uses an AC propulsion system instead of an internal combustion engine. So the first car was the Roadster. It was a $100,000, tiny little thing. It was built on a Lotus chassis. If anyone's ever seen a Lotus Elise, it looks like that. It's a two-door, little two-seater thing, and it zips back and forth. It gets like 200 miles to the charge. It takes like 5 hours to charge up, and it goes 0 to 60 in like 3.7 seconds, which is really, really fast. But the whole plan with Tesla wasn't to build an electric car. It was to build the best car that just happened to be electric. Mm-hmm. That's the way you get people into this. The idea being that if Toyota had come out with the Toyota Tundra and called it made it a hybrid and called it Super X-Drive with more torque and better mileage, then we'd all be driving hybrids today. But instead, they came out with this anemic little thing called the Prius, and people associate a lack of gas with a lack of power. Right. And that's what he wanted to avoid. So his plan was to lay out this expensive little tiny car and then show up with a slightly less expensive, more realistic everyday driving car, and then continue to do that until he got down to the $30,000 or $20,000 electric car that everybody could afford and would love and is a great car. And this second step, Project White Star, the mm-hmm. Tesla Model S, mm-hmm. is the Motor Trend Car of the Year. And the reason why is kind of astounding. They don't actually talk about its electronic engine too much when they talk about what makes it the Motor Trend Car of the Year. They have these things called like these categories: engineering excellence, advancement in design, efficiency, safety, value, performance of intended function, and it goes on. Like, these are the things that they judge like 30 something cars on. When you look at it, what they've done is they've looked at the car. It's a hatchback. It's the first. It goes from 0 to 60 in about 5 seconds. So it's sitting up there with like the BMW 5 Series or the Mercedes-Benz E-Class. It's a performance sedan, and in terms of its shape and, you know, the Audi A6, right? Mm-hmm. So it's sitting there along the lines of those devices, those cars, and it's the first car in the world that's a sport hatchback with third row adult seating. Why can it do that? It just so happens that it's got no axle going through the middle,
oh, right.
So there's more room in the car, right? That's a byproduct of the electronic engine. It's not, you know, it's not the fact that it has an electronic engine. It's just a byproduct, and that's what they got excited about. They got excited about something else too. In order to power that electronic engine, you need to have a massive lithium battery. Imagine your laptop's battery. Just take that out and hold it in your hand if you have a Windows laptop, or think about the heft of your MacBook Pro. And they have a massive, humongous battery on the bottom of the car. It was the only way to get a battery big enough that wouldn't throw the weight off. So it covers the entire bottom part of the car. Mm-hmm. And it's really heavy. It gives the car a lot of weight, which is, you wouldn't think is a good thing when you want efficiency, but it's a really good thing when you want performance. So you've got this car that's four doors. It can seat seven. And when it takes a corner at 60 miles an hour, that weight keeps the body roll from happening. That feeling that you have where one side of the car comes up and pushes everybody toward the other side of the car, it simply doesn't happen because it's got this humongous battery on the bottom keeping it grounded. So its handling is off the charts. It handles as well as a Ford GT, which is a dedicated sports car, even though it's this like sedan. Then there's just this idea that when you're – go ahead.
I think you're getting at this sort of deeper feeling that, like, being an electric car is not just a matter of, like, being a hippie. Like, it makes a better car all the way around. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's what I've seen a couple of these on the road. They are sick-looking cars. Like, they just like scream like quality
and performance.
And the fact that they've been able to go from like, you know, car that you might buy, like I feel like what he's gone is from car that like a rich person might buy for their midlife crisis to car that a rich person might buy for their family.
Right.
And then, as you said, move it down to part car that a normal person might buy for
their family. That's what I'm waiting for.
Like it's – yeah.
It's, I mean, it's got all these other little great features. Like the instrument panel inside the car is a 17-inch capacitive touchscreen. It's not an iPad. It's not anything else. But it's a 17-inch capacitive touchscreen. So imagine your iPad and then take that diagonal, the 9-point-whatever-inch diagonal, 9.7-inch angle from screen to screen, and push that to 17 inches, and you get an idea of how big that screen is. Now, everything is controlled on that screen. And while some people are worried that, you know, you can't feel the buttons, so you won't know when you're driving what to look at, it's designed in a way that's supposed to be native to the car. So everything's big enough for you to touch at a gesture and not necessarily like have to worry about hitting the exact right little app icon or whatever. It's not how it works. But what's also interesting is that it means that the functionality of the vehicle is easily augmented by Tesla software engineers. You get an update. The vehicle also – you know, it has in its package. So you see some cars with this now, but I think the not the base model, but the model right above it comes with a 4G hotspot in the car. So your car is connected.
Oh, nice! Wow.
And the data is being sent back to Tesla on a regular basis. Huh. So they're able to take all that data and figure out where the problems with the car are for when they do other engineering efforts, when they have to look at parts that they need to replace, things like that. So. It's a different type of experience in terms of running the vehicle because, you know, you've got this situation where you're not filling it up all the time. You've got 300 – they found like 330 miles straight without having to fill it up. So that's pretty much anywhere you're going to go from home and then come back to home. They drove it from Los Angeles to Las Vegas without any kind of hitch or problem. So it's a real vehicle. It really does get stuff done. And what's interesting also is that Tesla's working on this plan of – these pit stop locations. So you're driving from Vegas to LA and you stop at the Tesla place and they've got a hookup that will recharge your car about 165 miles in about half an hour. Now, is that the same as a 5-minute gas fill up? Absolutely not. But the idea is that they can bypass the normal controls that you use, the normal like safety controls mechanisms that are used when you're charging your car at home, and they can just funnel energy into the car. To move it forward. Oh, and they want to have these corridors, these Tesla corridors all across the country, which allow people to basically take their, you know, stop anywhere along a cross-country route or whatever and get that fill-up to happen. Now, obviously, they're going to work to get that fill-up to happen, take less time. It's the whole charging issue is the big issue with these cars. But these kinds of services on top of this kind of new driving experience and the car that it doesn't have any – fluid. It doesn't have any like it has like a little bit of hydraulic fluid, I think, but it doesn't have any oil in it. It doesn't have a whole bunch of the goop that comes out of your car normally, and it has very few moving parts. I believe the last count it had something like 12 or 16 moving parts in the whole entire vehicle. That's what's kind of exciting about these cars, and that's why Motor Trend named it the 2013 car of the year. Now for me, I'm less excited about the S and more excited about the upcoming X, which is a crossover vehicle that's based on the S, and every single wheel will have its own motor, which means it'll get the all-wheel drive I need to get to the mountains, and that sounds pretty exciting.
I'm just excited about whatever the price coming down, essentially, in future models, because I would just want to be able to afford one. I mean, it's plain and simple. All right, let's move on here. When Google launched Google Apps in 2006, August 2006, it was a service available at no cost to organizations of all shapes and sizes. Free was a fearsome price point, and it helped companies, small ones at first, start thinking the unthinkable. Maybe there's an alternative to paying for Microsoft Office. Free opened doors, even if it became clear in 2007 that Google hoped businesses would prefer paying $50 per user per year for their Google Apps Premier Edition, which subsequently was branded Google Apps for Business. As of Thursday, Google Apps is no longer available at no cost. The free lunch has ended. You get what you pay for because you can't get what you didn't pay for. That is, unless you already have it. Companies currently using the free version of Google Apps can continue to do so under the same terms. But the first taste was free, and now everyone has got to pay. And I think this comes out of – I think basically Google has been watching Apple and saying, you know, we don't have to give away our services. We don't have to be
– This is the same thing as the what we were talking about before with the subsidies on the phones.
Yeah, exactly.
And people have been hooked.
Yes.
Is it cheaper to do it – like a Microsoft license per user is not $50 as far as I can remember. So – you know, you're still getting a deal, but they're getting some return on their investment, which is not bad.
It's more than just Apple and Google. Like, so really excellent read if you're interested mm-hmm. in sort of more business side of startups. I just finished reading Beyond the Cloud by Mark Bernioff, the founder of Salesforce. And he Salesforce is really one of the first sort of like software as a service providers, and they really sort of pioneered a lot of the stuff that we sort of take for granted now, like free trials and everything. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting sort of look into sort of the marketing and sort of economics of cloud services. And the best practices and sort of accepted knowledge today is that if you're going to do a freemium model,
yeah,
it's much better to do a temporary free trial than a permanent free trial. Because the problem with a permanent free trial is that if you give people some level for free mm-hmm. indefinitely, then what they'll do is instead of upgrading to your premium product, even if it's nominal in terms of expense, they'll simply move their business flows around whatever your limits on the freemium are. So if your limit is 5 users, they'll figure out a way to make it worth 5 users because they're just like, it's free as long as we keep it under 5 users. How much can it be worth?
That's a Bezos thing. The power of free. The power of free shipping, the power of whatever. That makes people find all sorts of crazy ways to get
powerful. Even if it's against the interests of both the user and the seller, like even if the seller would objectively be better off spending $5 a month to have whatever premium service it is, and the seller would definitely be better off, like it's far better to just simply have a premium product and make the free trial be like really and truly a free trial mm-hmm. rather than a free permanent. Another book that's absolutely spectacular, a really, really, really old book, My Life in Advertising. It was written around the turn of the century by one of the guys who like basically invented modern advertising and like really came up with concepts like free trials and everything. It's really interesting to sort of see these concepts outside of the web world and understand like you just simply can't give away a product for free forever. Like at some point – it either has to be subsidized by advertising or it has to be subsidized by you.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
That being said,
I'm really glad that GroupTie got under the bar in terms of setting up the free service. So
I wonder how long that will continue. I mean, you think they'll keep all the grandfathered accounts for free for indefinitely, or
hopefully until we raise our Series A.
Yeah,
I mean, $50 per user.
I really love Google Apps.
It's not a huge barrier to entry.
If small businesses, but I think that they're also that's like the bottom line price for any user of Google Apps now, isn't it? Except for grandfathered accounts, like whether you're a small business or a single individual, it's still $50 per year.
Yeah, I think that's pretty reasonable. I'm just saying, in terms of what it costs to make that software. To design it, to do the upkeep, and a reasonable profit margin doesn't sound like
a
terrible
thing.
That's
a fair point.
I don't feel like I'm being fleeced.
Yeah, but except you're missing the sort of like – so I mean the problem with software and pricing is that the cost of development is astronomical relative to the marginal cost. And that's – it used to be, you know, with manufacturing that the marginal cost, like the cost of materials and manufacturing for a particular widget.
Right, but I'm saying you put some investment in with some high-end, some, you know, high-quality talent, and they suffer a little bit while this product gets out there and gets adopted. And then they cash in. And hopefully what you're doing is you're funding the next product that Google's making. It's kind of like Social Security, so to speak. Mm. I'm betting on Google to take the money that they're making because the marginal cost is only so much in order to fund the next big thing.
Glasses and driverless vehicles.
Exactly. Yeah.
So Apple and Google have joined forces to offer more than $500 million to buy Kodak's patents out of bankruptcy, said people familiar with the situation. The two companies competing for dominance of the smartphone market have partnered after leading two separate groups this summer to buy some of Kodak's 1,100 imaging patents. The patents for sale relate to the capture, manipulation, and sharing of digital images. Kodak is selling them to fund a turnaround after seeking Chapter 11 protection in January. So Apple and Google joining forces for these patents, ostensibly to use as either defense or offense against Microsoft or Nokia or who knows who else.
Well, I mean, maybe yes and no. I guess I think what I'm happy to see here is, again, this cooperative competition situation. Uh-huh. These guys are, I mean, especially in the wake of the HTC situation where Apple and Google are working, I mean, Apple and HTC are working together. They're sharing the data. They're doing all the sharing. That's important. The idea that they want to be collaborative instead of just kind of going into more and more of these like litigation-y battles, this is key.
They're cooperating in order to ostensibly be more litigious in the future.
No, they're cooperating, I'm hoping, that they're cooperating in order to be innovative. They're cooperating so they can avoid litigation situations in the future. Because Microsoft may be around, but Microsoft isn't competing with them the way that they're competing with each other. Mm-hmm. It's just clear. Microsoft's still got like less than 3% of the marketplace in the phone space. So if Apple and Google are going to get together and buy these patents and share them, save some money, and just not fight about that. Because the fighting is one of the things that, again, doesn't help the consumer. It doesn't help. The press gets all into it, and then like even from like a non-consumer perspective, you have to read about it, and it's like okay, girls, you're both pretty, right? So I just feel like we just have to like they have to work together so we can get over it and move on to the next big thing in phones, because I think we're at a place where we don't see it, we don't know what the next big thing is going to be on the telephones, and they need to be free enough to innovate in order to get there.
Is this what it's going to take, though? Is this what it's going to take to end the patent wars?
This type of collaboration is going to stop the patent wars.
Wow.
Well, see, I don't think it is, because it's too easy for – I mean, the problem is it's the
– Who wants to go up against Apple and Google? Tell me.
The problem is it doesn't matter. Like,
it does, because like, it's not about who's right with patents. It's about how much money you have to defend your patent. So the only people who are in a position to fight Apple and Google when they're working together on these types of patents is Microsoft and I guess formerly Nokia, but they don't have any money. And they're no one's going to do it. If you have two big battleships protecting an island and you've only got – the other guy's only got one battleship, the island isn't worth it. And that's what we need here.
So essentially what we're ending up with in patent world is this, the equivalent to the mutual assured destruction problem that theoretically solved the Cold War.
Right.
Except the reason why
No. You're off. And you're off because if they work together and they buy the patents together, there's no bomb that they would hit against one another. That's the point.
Against one another.
It's like the HTC deal. The HTC deal lays out just like the Intel AMD deal, right? It lays out that they're going to work together. They're going to share information instead of just try to like hide it all in the corner. And that's different from saying,
my point is,
I'm
like,
going to buy my patent.
There's too many players for that to work.
There isn't, because there are only two mobile operating systems that matter right now. Sorry, Microsoft. I mean, you're not there yet. You're going to get in there fine. You'll probably have a licensing agreement, just like you figured it out before. They're the only guys who have consistent licensing agreements when they want to use technology. They're smart about it, Microsoft is. But Google's going to buy these patents, and they're going to share. You know, the deal is going to be, hey, Apple, I'm going to use this for Android. If Google's smart, Apple's going to be like, fine, I'm going to use this for iOS, which means HTC and ZTE and Huawei and all the other like little – like tiny companies that are making Android phones, they have access to these now because it's in the Android terms of service, the use of these in the SDK. You see what I'm saying, Chris? It's diffusing what could be a situation. It's not a question of Google saying, I'm going to use it for myself or Motorola. It's a question of Google saying, I'm going to use it for Android. And anyone who's using Android's SDK has access to these.
See, I'm not thinking as much in terms of the particular players in the market as in terms of the sort of overall game theory, which I still think is very poisonous to the industry. I mean, it's great that Apple and Google realize this and can sort of like work together to sort of relieve the tensions. The problem is, I still think that the advantage that any third party gets to the market by waging a patent war is too tempting. Like,
give me an example.
The possibility of tying up your competitors in litigation while you get something out in market, or tying up your competitors with something while you develop something for the market, is just too tempting for any third party, whether or not it's a patent troll in Texas's 9th Eastern District or some other company decides that they want to move into the mobile market. Say,
I don't think I'm following you. Could you give me – I need something more concrete to understand where you're coming from. Like, so Apple and Google buy these patents. They get together. Each of them spend $250 million to buy these patents. And now you're saying they're going to work together to stop new people from getting into the space?
No, I mean, so the idea behind getting these new patents is if they get the patents, then they both have them and they both have more arsenal against each other. And so there's less of
an advantage. More arsenal against each other. That's where your logical leap doesn't work. There's no arsenal against each other.
What's the point of having a patent except to sue people?
But they both have more arsenal against other competitors.
Okay. But they're not fighting each other. The whole idea is they're going to buy them, so they won't fight over them.
But it certainly doesn't – I mean, why are they both going at it together? Like, if Google were to just simply get it, then Google will have more ability to get other
– What you're suggesting is that we extend patent – that the patent warfare is the paradigm that they wish to continue. That is not what
I don't think it's the that they wish to do. I think it's the one that they have to. So
they
let's,
don't though.
Let's
you don't,
say that Google
this is not the way,
decided
this is not the way they, patent litigation, patent intellectual property deals have been. Like the what we've seen in the we've seen recently is the aberration, not the rule. This is going back to sanity. This is them saying, "Hey, look, you spend half the money on them, and I spend half the money on them, and we all get access to all of them. We both get access to all of them, so we don't have to fight about them." That's what's
but
going on.
You have
on
to look
here.
At it from you have to step outside of the individual players and just look at the game theory. So say you have two companies, companies A and B.
I think you're getting too abstract. You're going too academic on something that is clearly a business decision designed to move innovation forward.
But it's a business decision based by smart people who understand the game theory of it. Like so here's my question. Why is not one of them buying all the patents? So say Google decided that it
both of them are buying all the patents. They're not splitting the baby, Chris. If they're five patents, they each get five patents. They're each just paying half for them, so they both have the right to all of them.
This feels like kind of a like a detente solution to the option of engaging in a bidding war for these patents, where each of them are going to try and top each other. This way, they say, okay, we're only going to spend $500 million. In total, between that's $250 million a piece, and we each get all of the patents.
Exactly, which
exactly.
is
exactly.
So what are we?
So my
about?
Point is that, like, if it was just a matter of keeping other people out of the market, then each side would be motivated to let the other one pay the full price for the patents, and therefore they wouldn't have to pay anything for the patents, and then that other side would sue any new people into the market and effectively keep people out of the market. My point is, because they're both going for it, that means that they both realize that there's not just an advantage in keeping other people out of the market, but in essentially keeping up a detent against the other side. So by both of
what's
them
the other side
it,
though
the other side is Apple if you're Google and Google if you're Apple. You don't want Apple to have exclusive rights on those patents. You want to also have rights on those patents.
Right. And as long as they continue to do that, they will compete with one another on what they do with the patents, not just
exactly.
having patents.
which is an inherently unstable situation, because any third player that also has a huge patent arsenal, say IBM decides that they want to go back into mobile.
Hardware.
Yeah. I mean, IBM has an unbelievable patent arsenal. Like, any other player that has a large patent arsenal could very easily disrupt the situation, or any other company that just simply has deep enough pockets to play a patent war for a while could easily, like, start fighting against them in that market while they develop something to go on forward. Like, I'm not saying – I agree with you that it's good, but I want to say that this is not a stable solution to, like, these patent wars, which are honestly a waste of money. Like, are any of these patents, like, ensuring that more innovative products are making it to market? No, they're just simply ensuring that the two major companies prevent other people from entering the market, any other innovation from happening.
I mean, that's the pessimistic way to look at it, and there's some validity there. I'm looking at it from an optimistic perspective, which says they're trying to make sure that that when it comes to what they're doing, it's not going to get in the way of their ability to innovate, which is, I think, the thing that analysts are looking at right now. What's the next big thing in mobile? We don't know, but no matter what happens, there's going to be a lawsuit about it. So, you know, it's already, you know what I mean? Like, it's,
that's pessimistic.
I mean, that's the de facto situation
yeah, yeah.
right now.
That,
unfortunately, no matter what happens,
I'm pessimistic when it comes to anything regarding patents, because it just seems like a giant waste of money that's not being spent on
innovation,
product marketing, engineering, right. or support.
Well, I mean, Apple's got so much money that it doesn't matter what they spend it on, because they've already allocated the budget for product.
To be perfectly honest, I'd rather they spent it on yachts, because at least that would help the yacht industry. Like,
you've been in this for far too long.
Let's transition into our last story here. Speaking of Apple, and what they're going to be spending things on. So Apple CEO Tim Cook revealed that one of the existing Mac lines will be manufactured exclusively in the United States next year, making comments during an exclusive interview with Brian Williams, broadcast Thursday night on NBC's Rock Center. Mac fans will have to wait to see which Mac line it will be, because Apple, widely known for its security, left it vague. The announcement could be good news for a country that has been struggling with an unemployment rate of around 8% for some time and has been bleeding good-paying factory jobs to lower-wage nations such as China. Tim Cook said he believes the U.S. education system is failing to produce enough people with the skills needed for modern manufacturing processes, but added that he hopes that the new Mac project will help spur others to bring manufacturing back to the U.S. And the odds-on favorite for what line it's going to be is the Mac Pro. A lot of people feel it's going to be the Mac Pro because of a number of reasons.
Well, won't that just mean that it's going to be – okay, hold on. Won't that just mean it's going to be assembled in the U.S.? Because the Mac Pro components, or many of them, are off the shelf. So they're coming from China, the video card, the hard drives, all those things. If Apple were to make a Macintosh – inside, I guess it's a Mac now, it's not a Macintosh. If Apple were to make a Mac inside the U.S. and put that together inside the U.S., then using one of the custom boards that are now found in the Retina display MacBook Pros or the MacBook Airs, along with the custom batteries, those are things that I can see actually being manufactured in this country, especially because the super hidden secret about all this – well, there are two hidden secrets about all this. I guess all secrets are hidden, but the first one is they're going to be making extensive use of these new robots that have this AI that allows you to teach them how to put things together. So a lot of the people won't be making and like zipping things together or welding things or whatever. They'll be making use of these robots. So there's that. And two, a big issue here, you know, to go back to Chris's point earlier, is the intellectual property damage that occurs when you do this stuff in China. The fake Mac store, the fake Apple stores, the fake versions of the products, all that stuff. It's going to happen a lot less in a country that respects the intellectual property of the manufacturer. So, but I do feel as if the actual work, the building of the device, the Mac Pro doesn't have enough, unless they're making a brand new Mac Pro that's got the built-in board and the built-in video card and all that stuff.
Well, I know that they are planning on revamping that Mac Pro line.
Sure. And I mean, it'd be great, but I think the Mac Pro's strength and the reason why it has such a popular following it has such a following, even though it's not the most popular device they make, or rather it's the least popular device they make, is because you can buy off-the-shelf products and throw them in the ATX-based case.
Sure, sure. They're easier to build and customize. But I know I know that if it is the Mac Pro line and they revamp that line, there's already a built-in audience of like just about every media professional in the industry. Because we all use Mac Pros. We use Mac Pros for all of our editing equipment.
Yeah, have there been any benches about like the latest MacBook Pro with Retina display versus the latest version of the Mac Pro? I feel like I read somewhere that they're neck and neck at this point. So really? They're going to have to use, because the Apple, you know, the Intel chipset that's being used in the current Mac Pro isn't the newest.
Right. But we don't want something that's neck and neck with technology that's years old. You know, we want an advance in the technology, and I feel like these new Mac Pros,
you want the new hotness, not the old busted joint.
Exactly. What do you guys feel about this? Do you think that this is a good idea to have Macs made in the USA? Would you pay extra for
it? It'd be a nice experiment.
Yeah,
I mean, if it works out, who couldn't like it? You know, like it's Apple's an American company making great things. It'd be cool if it could make those great things in America.
They used to make Apple computers in America.
We used to make a lot of crap in America.
All right.
I mean, I don't know. I guess here's what I feel like. Like, it's great that they're doing this.
Yeah.
I feel like at best, it's a symbolic measure. I mean, like the factors that have been sort of leading to the loss of American manufacturing and also the loss of sort of the middle class manufacturing sort of jobs, I think are far larger than any one company can really make a dent in. I mean, the problems is not just, I mean, as Dwayne was saying, it's pipeline. Like if you're going to make a particular product, like, part of the reason why so many companies make stuff in China, it's not just because it's cheap. It's not even cheap anymore. Like, good factories in China cost almost as much as good factories in the U.S. cost. But the fact is, all the subsidiary parts are next door. And that drastically reduces your cost of manufacturing. Like, if you're making a motherboard and all the chip manufacturers are right next door and all the, you know, silicon processing plants are right next door to them, then it's way easier to build something regardless of who it is and how much
unless
it costs.
Unless you're using a new manufacturing process, which might be an issue here. We also have to realize who the messenger is. Tim Cook isn't some CEO that like came up through business development and like connections and things like that to get where he's gotten. I mean, I don't know his schooling, but I do know that he spent, you know, pretty much the last decade with working on the logistics of making these
products
happen.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
because he's been working in those operations, he would be highly qualified to determine what could or could not be made in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when you look at the legacy of Apple's innovation and the way they detest infringement on that innovation, you can't really afford to manufacture your newest products in China, especially because over the last several years, you know, we saw the iPhone 5 come out early. We've seen like all these, you know, we know about the glass this and the glass that. There are too many in that space, there are too many products being made in which, you know, the reporters can put two and two together and spoil the surprise, as it were. And I think that's an issue that they want to work on. Just their normal secretive PR, it helps to be in America on some level. And then there's just also the idea that if they can get the commitment out of American manufacturing facilities that they've gotten out of Chinese ones, and that's really the biggest issue. The Chinese ones will create dorms, and the people will work like crazy. But in this age of, like, they want a Halo product perhaps now, but they want something for sure that isn't going to get the negative scrutiny that their Chinese-made products are. Mm-hmm. You know, they can divert attention from in a PR perspective away from that crazy Chinese problematic people killing themselves issue because they're making stuff in America. So it might be a feint. It might be I don't really know if it's a boondoggle, but it might be just a way to a gimmick to look away. But it might also be represent a new way of manufacturing. I really think there is that.
You know, one thing I've sort of become a little bit more aware of is that, like, as much as we think of, and this is going to be counter to my previous point, but as much as we think of American business as this sort of like giant force that operates under like rational principles in aggregate, like at its core, like it still has, you know, executives at the top who are, you know, subject to all the same, you know, social pressures and everything that everyone else is. And if all their other executives are manufacturing in China, then it's going to take somebody with, you know, quite a bit of additional balls to go out there and be like, you know, we're going to switch our manufacturing process back to the US. I mean, like maybe somebody like Tim Cook with his, like, you know, sort of level of, I don't know, like prestige within that, you know, community might be able to actually be successful at getting this out there. I don't know. It would just be interesting to see where it comes and if it makes any difference.
Well,
I view it more as an interesting experiment.
We shall see one way or the other. And I know a lot of people who are going to be wanting to snap up that Mac Pro if it is, in fact, the Mac Pro line. Let's go around the table here. I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. You can also find me hanging out at, it looks like Plan 8 Media for the foreseeable future.
All right.
Just doing some writing over there.
Cool.
Plan8.tv.
Plan8.tv. All right. And Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
Well, most of my work these days you can find online at grouptie.com. I haven't really had a great deal of time for blogging or media work lately. But my media stuff, you can find me every Monday and Friday on Startup Digest. I have an email newsletter there. And you can find my personal blogs at chrismonroe.com. And I'm always tweeting the most interesting stuff that I find around the internet at Chris Monroe on Twitter.
All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com. gplus.to/MrBabyMan is my Google Plus account. It's got all my social links there. Facebook.com/MrBabyMan and Twitter.com/MrBabyMan. Just search for Mr. Babyman on the internet. You'll find me. Check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network by going to geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes link is in the upper right-hand sidebar. Our show is on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices by going to Stitcher.com, Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send your story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And I'm not entirely sure when our next show is going to be. I'm hoping sometime immediately after Christmas. Although, Dwayne, you'll be absent because you'll be on vacation.
Yeah, I'm going to be out of town.
So until then, that's it for this episode of The Drill Down, and thanks for joining us.